There's one train that goes to San Francisco, but it's a little slower than the one you want. There's one other train leaving, but it's not going to San Francisco. It's going to hell.
All aboard.
I got the feeling there's something right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, at 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI. In Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM. In Palinville, New York on 102.9 FM WLPP. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And yes, coast to coast and around the world on the streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth. 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling action-packed adventure. As usual, Desi Doyen is our producer, is at our side. How are you, Desiree?
Yes, I'm doing okay.
All right, hang on. Right. Buckle up.
I know.
Coming up, the Bernie Sanders revolution is still at a crossroads, at least for some. And how will and how should Sanders supporters, his most fervent supporters, move forward this November? Most of them seem to be on record right now supporting the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton, as Sanders has requested. But there are still a number of hardcore burners out there trying to figure out how to proceed. We will discuss that today with Ernest A. Canning, who recently penned Revolution at a Crossroad at bradblog.com. He's also our legal analyst at long-serving legal analyst at bradblog.com, who covers voting rights issues. We're going to talk to him about that as well momentarily. We've been talking a lot about voting rights over the past week or so, and election concerns about the elections, the electoral system, and everything else. We've seen a lot of really good and encouraging voting rights decisions in a whole bunch of states. About six different states, at least, over the past 2 weeks or so. Texas, Wisconsin, North Carolina. What am I forgetting here? Wisconsin, Michigan, North Dakota. There's so much good news that I've lost track of where it's all happening. How often does that happen on the Bradcast? Nonetheless, this item in from last night, the president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, was arrested on Monday after staging a sit-in at the Roanoke office of Virginia Congressman Bob Goodlatte to demand a hearing on the Voting Rights Act, which was signed into law 51 years ago on Saturday. Cornell Brooks, the NAACP president, and Stephen Green, national director of the group's youth and college division, were arrested shortly after the congressman's office closed at 5 p.m. on Monday. He said, Green said in an email that the men were charged with trespassing, a misdemeanor, and then they were released. Officers with the Roanoke Police Department had allowed the protest to continue throughout the day and then returned after the offices were closed and arrested Brooks and Green. When they refused to leave, nearly 30 protesters occupied the Republican's office on Monday morning, demanding that Goodlatte, as chairman of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, convene a hearing on the Voting Rights Act. Earlier in the day, Brooks spoke to The Guardian in a phone call from the office, said people bled, sweated, and died for the right to vote. Why can't Congress conduct a hearing on the right to vote? All we're asking for is a hearing. It's not radical, he said. Indeed, for more than 50 years, the Voting Rights Act has stood as one of the most important legal achievements of the 1960s civil rights era. In 2013, however, the U.S. Supreme Court struck at the heart of that 1965 law in a 5-4 decision that allowed 9 states, mostly in the South, to make changes to electoral rules without approval from federal authorities in Washington. Nonetheless, in a string of legal victories last month in Texas, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Kansas, that was the one I forgot, and North Dakota, courts have ruled against voter ID and proof of citizenship laws, striking them down or weakening them. And those rulings were seen as a sweeping victory for the voting rights activists and the U.S. Department of Justice, which had challenged the restrictive laws, according to the a press release put out by the NAACP. So the fight to fix what the U.S. Supreme Court broke in the Voting Rights Act continues, and the Republicans in Congress continue to refuse to even hold a hearing to discuss it. Nonetheless, in North Carolina, now that a federal court has struck down the worst voter suppression law in the nation, by far since the Jim Crow era, getting rid of cuts that Republicans had made in North Carolina to early voting, to same day registration, new photo ID restrictions, all sorts of stuff. Right now, those provisions have been cut down after the Fourth Circuit Court found that they targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. Unquote. That's what the appellate court found. So now counties around the state are trying to figure out in the 90 or so days that we have left before the general election how they are going to deal with rolling back the new law that had been put in place for a number of elections. And we talked a little bit yesterday about Guilford County, North Carolina, which is where Greensboro was, which is where the original Woolworth's sit-in took place back in 1960 when four African Americans sat down to order, were refused. They would not serve them. It led to months of demonstrations in Greensboro and eventually desegregation of the Woolworth lunch counter, and it really kicked off the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Well, in Greensboro County, the two Republicans on the Guilford County Board of Elections, now that the statewide law has been struck down, it's fallen to the counties to figure out how they're going to do early voting, how long the early voting period is going to be before the elections. And in the old days, they would have had, not the really old days, but since the Voting Rights Act in 1965, those counties would have had to get clearance from the federal government for changes to their voting laws. Now they don't have to anymore. Now they can do anything they want. And now, since it's up to the counties again, instead of that state law, which has been essentially struck down, the counties are looking at themselves limiting early voting, as we discussed yesterday in Guilford County, Greensboro. Well, the good news here is that the Greensboro, the Guilford County Board of Elections met in Greensboro, and there was such a good turnout. So many folks came out. According to Democracy North Carolina's executive director, Bob Hall, he put out a statement late yesterday saying, "We are reminded today that everyone benefits when a community mobilizes to stop a discriminatory rollback of voting rights. People filled the meeting room, and their spirit and energy carried the day." And indeed, the Republican attempt to shut down early voting sites at a number of universities, including A&T University, which is where those students who protested at Woolworth's so many years ago in the 1960s to shut down a site, a polling site that was serving there. That attempt has been pushed back despite the 2-1 majority that Republicans had on that board of elections. That, thanks to people turning out, speaking, participating in their democracy, paying attention to these provisions. This is how elections are won and lost, on the ground, by citizens, by observers, and so forth. And this is happening, by the way, now all over North Carolina as they figure out how to, properly roll back from that statewide law. We saw a similar victory today in Wake County at the Wake County Board of Elections. Actually, this was late Monday. They too have decided to expand to return early voting to the 17 days that it had been prior to this horrible Republican law in North Carolina, which restricted it down to 10. So a lot of, I would say, encouraging news in North Carolina and elsewhere in the country. Here to talk about this and some of these, surprisingly good pieces of news from over the past week, as well as about Bernie Sanders, is our friend Ernest A. Canning. He has served for many years as a legal analyst for us at bradblog.com. He's a retired attorney, an author, Vietnam veteran. He hasn't been able to write much for us over recent months at bradblog.com because he's been serving as a senior advisor to Veterans for Bernie. But he's back more and more of late since Sanders' endorsement of Hillary Clinton and since the spate of encouraging voting rights rulings from courts, state and federal, all over the country in recent weeks. I hope to talk about both of those things today with Ernie. Ernie Canning, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
How you doing, Brad?
I think I'm doing all right, given all the pretty good news we've been seeing of late when it comes to so many of the issues that you and I both have been covering for a whole lot of years at bradblog.com at this point. And it looks like, guess what, Ernie? You were right on a lot of them, and the good guys, the voting rights advocates, are winning on a lot of them. What existing challenges do you see that are out there that we still may need to be worried about when it comes to voting rights between now and November, Ernie?
Well, I think you had a guest on from the ACLU that said that these don't cover all of them. So there are a lot of remaining issues, particularly in the jurisdictions where these cases have not come down. They still have, for example, photo ID in Indiana, where mm-hmm. some people, not as many as the other states, are going to be denied their opportunity to vote because of that law, which is totally unnecessary. The biggest issue, as I see it, is not so much the one immediately facing the courts as it is facing the electorate, and that's because a lot of this good news could be undone if Donald Trump wins in November and appoints someone who would be another Antonin Scalia on the court.
Indeed, and we'll get into that, no doubt, in our Bernie section here in a moment. Can the Supreme Court screw up, as you can see, any of these very encouraging decisions that have been made? The most conservative appellate court in the land, the Fifth Circuit Court down in Texas, forced Texas to at least weaken their photo ID restriction. Can the Supreme Court screw up any of these encouraging rulings that have been made between now and November, as you see it, or are these good rulings pretty much baked in the cake at this point?
Well, I mean, there's always the potential for them to issue a stay given of these really good rulings like the one in North Carolina. I doubt seriously that they will, and one of the reasons why we had so many of these cases come down when they did was that I think the appellate courts, or in some of the cases the district courts, were trying to come in with their decision in sufficient time so that they don't run afoul of the Purcell principle of this notion that the Supreme Court has adopted over recent years, that if you make changes in election laws at the last minute, that runs the risk of too much confusion at the mm-hmm. polls. And they seem to think that's more important than people losing their voting rights.
Yes, 600,000 potentially disenfranchised, already registered legal voters in Texas who might not be able to vote. But, the Purcell principle, we don't want to cause chaos, so let's just let those 600,000 lose their vote. That's essentially what they've done in the past. Hopefully that it's going to be harder to do now that Scalia is dead, and any such decision to come to the court would probably be a 4-4 tie. and I guess would go with the therefore go with the lower court's ruling in favor of voters. Ernie Canning, there's been, you know, a lot of these really huge victories in state and federal courts alike in at least six different states in these recent weeks. Many of those rulings, those federal court rulings, found that these Republican voting restrictions were in violation of Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act. Now, that section of the Voting Rights Act protects against racial discrimination at the voting booth in all 50 states, but really only after the law has already been enacted, already been implemented, and it requires the challenger to those laws to demonstrate racial discrimination. Now, that's different from Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was largely gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. That section, had it still been in play, would likely have blocked a lot of these laws that you know, we're now dealing with, would have blocked a lot of these laws before they went into effect, because it would have required preclearance from the federal government in those jurisdictions with, you know, a history of racial discrimination. Also, it would have required those jurisdictions to demonstrate that the new law was not discriminatory. So do I basically have that right before I get to my question? Am I explaining that correctly?
You're doing, and in fact, in the case of Texas, the law had in fact been blocked by both first by the Department of Justice and then by a unanimous three-judge U.S. District mm-hmm. Court panel in the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And they had blocked it because there was no question but that that law would have a significant disparate impact on and retrogressive impact on the right of mm-hmm. African Americans and Hispanics to vote. In Texas, for example, people that were poor, didn't have a car and didn't have a driver's license, might have to travel up to 200 miles round trip to the nearest Department of Public Safety to obtain the so-called free ID on a day when they were supposedly working and couldn't afford not to, to lose work in order to obtain the necessary photo ID. So when the court in District of Columbia made it clear from day one that the Texas law not only would not meet the criteria of Section 5, but they went on to say that it wouldn't meet Section 2.
Well, that's right. And they struck it down at the time. And the only reason that Texas was able to sort of re-implement it was because the Supreme Court had gutted Section 5. And then you had this really long challenge under Section 2, which has been going on for years now. So here's my question for you, Ernie. When Chief Justice John Roberts gutted that particular section of the Voting Rights Act, he did so by claiming that racial discrimination at the voting booth, while it still exists a little bit, it's nothing like it was back in 1965 when the Voting Rights Act was passed. He said that, you know, we don't need preclearance anymore for these laws. If there are discriminatory laws, they can be challenged under Section 2. In all 50 states, therefore, we don't need to apply these special conditions to this, you know, these few states with this history of discrimination. Well, all of these now successful challenges of late, Ernie, have been largely under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, finding these laws to be in violation of that section. So, doesn't that prove that John Roberts was both right and wrong? In that, there's a lot of racial discrimination clearly still going on. I mentioned the Fourth Circuit in North Carolina found that law that had targeted African Americans with surgical precision. So he's wrong. There is a lot of racial discrimination going on. But also, isn't he right that, well, Section 2 apparently was sufficient to challenge all of those cases because it has now succeeded in striking them down?
Well, actually, what these latest cases show is that they substantiate the blistering dissent. The case you're referring to where Roberts said that was Shelby Kennedy versus Alabama versus Holder.
Mm-hmm.
And she took aim at the core assumption made by the majority in that case, that increases in African American voter participation during the period that Section 5 preclearance mandate was in effect, which is 1965 to 2013, suggested that preclearance was no longer needed.
Who's she? Who are you talking about, Ernie?
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
In the minority.
In the Shelby County dissent, she said, throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. I think the North Carolina decision is probably the most significant of the decisions because of the factual analysis. First, the court set forth that North Carolina is racially polarized when it comes to voting. In other words, you can predict where somebody votes based on whether they're African-American or white. And the interesting thing was they said that during that same period, 1980 to 2013, there were over 50 objection letters to proposed election laws in North Carolina that were filed by the DOJ. So there were some 50 laws between 1980 and 2013 that would have been passed that were discriminatory, but Section 5 blocked them. And during that same period, private plaintiffs successfully pursued 55 successful cases under Section 2. So the discrimination was there. The issue was that the law that was in place was working to prevent it from becoming law. And what they did by gutting Section 5, I think I put in the article I wrote that it was somewhat akin to unleashing a pack of race-conscious rabid dogs. And what happened here, what the telling feature of this case is, the legislature didn't just, you know, pass this law. And what they did was in each one of these comprehensive laws that they came out, it wasn't just photo ID, it was photo ID, early voting, all these things. They first got the statistics to find out how African Americans were affected. And in every case, when they found that they were harmful to the African Americans specifically, as opposed to whites, rather than try and assist in not violating their rights to vote, as the court used it, they targeted them with surgical precision to deny their right to vote.
They took that information on how it was that the voters broke down as far as race and so forth, and they said, oh, okay, look, black voters tend to vote on Sunday, early voting, souls to the polls days, so we're going to limit that. We're going to end that Sunday souls to the polls day. They knew in advance they had this information. They requested this information, and then they used that specific information to keep the African Americans from make it harder for them to vote. Correct?
Well, that's correct. And let me give you something real specific because it applies to all these photo ID laws. The Republicans obtained data that showed that a disproportionate number of African Americans don't possess the narrowly approved photo ID. They also learned that very few African Americans cast absentee ballots, whereas a comparative high percentage of white North Carolinians, Carolinians vote absentee. And while there's instances of absentee voter fraud, the record revealed that there had never been a single prosecution in the state of North Carolina for in-person voter impersonation, which is the only type of fraud that can be prevented by polling place photo ID. So what did they do? They saw fit, let's have strict photo ID for in-person only,
at the
and
polling
the predominantly
place.
White absentee voters were exempted from the photo ID mandate.
So the absentee voters, no problem, no photo ID necessary. Yeah, we need to fix that Voting Rights Act. So I congratulate and encourage the folks, the NAACP folks and the others who are pressing Congress at this point to try to at least have a hearing to restore the Voting Rights Act. Ernie Canning, I want to take a quick break, and we're going to turn the page a little bit here and talk about your article at BradBlog this week, Revolution at a Crossroad. What it is that, you know, hardcore supporters of Bernie Sanders, what they should now do, what their options are as we head towards November. So let's take a quick break here. Ernie, stand by. We'll take a quick break, and we will come back with that and much more here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away.
Cool babies, strange but
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Will Bernie Sanders supporters burn down the House this November? There's a lot of them out there still trying to figure out how they should vote. Many of them kind of mad at Bernie Sanders himself for endorsing Hillary Clinton. Here was Bernie Sanders just a week or two ago at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
I understand that many people are disappointed about the final results of the nominating process. I think it's fair to say that no one is more disappointed than I am. Our revolution continues. Election days come and go. This election is not about and has never been about Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or any of the other candidates who sought the presidency. This election is about and must be about the needs of the American people and the kind of future we create for our children and our grandchildren.
That was Bernie Sanders speaking on the first night of the Democratic National Convention just a week or two ago in Philadelphia, calling on his supporters to vote for Hillary Clinton in order to keep the Sanders political revolution moving forward. Ernie Canning is still with us here. He is an attorney. He is a veteran, a Vietnam veteran, and he's been working with the Veterans for Bernie group. He's been a senior advisor over there at vetsforbernie.org, which is why we haven't been able to enjoy much of Ernie's work over the past year or so, because trying to avoid conflicts of interest. We cover elections at the at bradblog.com, and so to avoid writing about the presidential primary, he's been writing elsewhere at LA Progressive and at Vets for Bernie and so forth. But now that the primaries are behind us, Ernie wrote a sort of a personal essay, in a sense, if you will, entitled "Revolution at a Crossroad," this week at bradblog.com, where he went through the various options and his, I think, recommendations for how Sanders voters should move ahead. Ernie, let's walk through the possibilities of that you spelled out, the various possibilities for strong, I would say fierce Sanders supporters like yourself, through the various possibilities that you guys are facing trying to figure out what to do in November. So the first one: not voting at all, not happy about Bernie Sanders not being the Democratic nominee this year, and just staying at home this year. Is that a good possibility as you see it, Ernie Canning?
Actually, I think it would be a betrayal of the Sanders-led revolution, because the entire focus of the Sanders movement is active participation in the political process. And the only way you're going to achieve democratic accountability is going to be by participating in democracy. I have a quote that Sanders wrote over the weekend in an op-ed at the LA Times. He says, "I understand that many of my supporters are disappointed by the final results of the nominating process." And he went on to say, "But being despondent and inactive is not going to improve anything." And I tend to agree with that. One of the reasons why we currently have majorities in both houses of Congress is because so many people, 83% of the electorate, stayed home in November of 2014. If you want to accomplish all this stuff we've been talking about, voter suppression, if you want to accomplish the Republicans' goal without them having to spend so much time and effort, just stay home.
And, of course, they don't have to stay home. They can still show up and vote for some of the other candidates. They can even put in a write-in candidate, I suppose. But there are other candidates on the ballots, at least in most states. And you go through the major options, at least at the moment.
Let me back you up for a minute. One of the things, the very first thing I put in here is that, and this has to do with a lot of the Sanders supporters that are screaming that the the nomination process was stolen and they have no hard evidence of it. I realize that there's a dispute as to how valid some of these statisticians' analysis are regarding exit polls. But the one thing that's clear is the United States is not Austria. I don't know of any court in the land that would accept that kind of evidence and overturn an election. And you're really talking about not one presidential primary. You're talking about presidential primaries and caucuses in 50 states, in the District of Columbia and elsewhere. And on top of that, you'd have an issue of, if anybody actually filed a case, of timeliness, because most election statutes require you to, if you're going to challenge the result of the election, to do it right away. So to talk about and complain about, well, gee, I'm going to sit this one out, or I'm, you know, there's no way I'm going to vote for Hillary because I think the election was stolen, that's not going to get you anywhere, because there's not going to be a do-over. So that's the first thing people have to realize, that, you know, to complain about that. First off, I don't think there's hard evidence of it, but even if there was, you're not going to overturn, they're not going to redo the primary, so you can't go back.
There you go.
And
well,
you can't sit still, which is voting. So then the question is, do you turn to the extreme right, which is Donald Trump? I think that's unthinkable. I think who you had on that said it would be a move towards madness and certainly would be involved in fascism. I think that's a betrayal of every soldier that died in World War II. To run the risk of a fascist America is just unthinkable. Well, but that is really the risk that you have with Donald Trump.
Let me play Bill Maher had a kind of a fun take on this. Do you have that available? Here was Bill Maher's thought on it. And he was basically saying that he was sort of dismissing the idea of a third party candidate and said, basically, you got two choices. And here's the way he described it.
You're on a train station.
Yes.
Right here in L.A. You want to go to San Francisco. There's a wedding up there. You got to get there. There's one train that's going to San Francisco, but it's a little slower than the one you want. There's one other train leaving, but it's not going to San Francisco. It's going to hell. That's not fair. It's not going to hell. It's going to San Diego, which is a lovely city, but it's not where you want to go. You want to go to San Francisco. The only other train is going in the opposite direction. Do you get on the train that's going in the direction you want to go, but slower, or do you go to San Diego?
So that was his, Bill Maher's, argument to Cornel West, a huge Bernie Sanders supporter, about, Hillary Clinton may not be Bernie Sanders, but at least she is going in the direction that progressives and Sanders supporters wish to go, versus Donald Trump going in the opposite direction towards, as you described, Bernie, fascism. But it's not really a choice of two. There are other candidates. So libertarian candidate Gary Johnson is one of them. You describe him in your piece. Why shouldn't Bernie Sanders supporters vote for Gary Johnson?
Well, I call that, it's not a progressive alternative. It's really an oblique turn to the right, not quite as far right as. But the thing you have to understand about libertarian philosophy is that it focuses exclusively on individual liberty versus the government and ignores or fails to appreciate the dangers to individual liberty posed by the tyranny of a corporate-controlled economy. One thing I know I pointed out that the 1980 candidate for the Libertarian VP spot was David Koch of
David
the infamous Koch brothers.
Yeah.
But beyond that, there was a November 3, 2014 Mother Jones article called the Koch 130 that talked about all these think tanks and educational institutions that the libertarian operations that were funded by the Kochs and really gave them rise to the definition of the Kochtopus. You've got places like the Cato Institute. Mm-hmm. The entire libertarian spectrum is really, even though a lot of the supporters don't realize it, individual liberty without social responsibility, knowingly or otherwise, is destructive of community and equitable economy and the environment. And let me just back up a minute to the thing with Donald Trump. It isn't just that the train's going in the opposite direction. You talked about the cases we were just talking about. That could all be reversed if we put a Trump nominee on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And as Senator Kennedy said in 1991, if you appoint somebody that isn't committed to the Constitution, you're endangering our individual freedoms and our nation, and not just for the next election. We're talking about, he said, we cannot undo such a mistake in the next election or even in the next generation. And he said that in 1991 at the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing. He's still there and will probably be there for another quarter century.
Indeed.
So when we're talking about control of the Supreme Court, you've got Ginsburg is 83 years old now. We've got an open seat. Anthony Kennedy is 80, and Stephen Breyer will be 78 on August 15. So you've got four potential appointments that could occur in the next 4 years to the Supreme Court, and you'll never be able to repair that if Donald Trump becomes president.
And I think that Democrats are somewhat, at a bit of a disadvantage, because for so many years they've been saying, hey, you have to vote for us because of the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court. But now you really do have all of these seats. You already have Scalia's seat that is sitting there vacant, and you may have as many as three more to be appointed by the next president. So this is, you're right, Ernie, this is for real this time. But let me move on, because our time is short here. You mentioned the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson. You say he's out because of his politics. And I don't want to get into a definition of what libertarianism is and isn't. But I think it's fair to say that it is not sort of the progressive democratic socialism that Bernie Sanders is in favor of. But what about Green Party nominee Dr. Jill Stein? She was officially nominated over the weekend in Houston at the Green Party National Convention. She is certainly progressive. She certainly embodies many of the ideals of Bernie Sanders. Why shouldn't people vote for, Bernie Sanders supporters move their support over to Jill Stein as you see it?
On substance, I think Dr. Stein is a fabulous candidate. And I think that she far more embodies the progressive principles, in fact, maybe even more so than Bernie Sanders himself. But there's an astute observation that Otto von Bismarck made, and that is politics are the art of the possible. And if Sanders faced a lot of obstacles and within the Democratic Party, Stein faces a lot more. One of the problems is Sanders appeared on the ballot in all 50 states. Stein and the Green Party have ballot access. This is as of July 10. I know they're still working at more states, mm-hmm. but they only had ballot access in 24 states. Where Sanders may have had a constricted debate schedule, Stein's going to probably be excluded from all debates. And you certainly haven't seen anything with regard to Dr. Stein of the kind of massive appearances that we saw with Bernie early on. I attended one in Los Angeles. There were 28,000 people there, and I should have brought earplugs because the decibel level was so high. But the bottom line is that there are just too many obstacles. It's just unlikely. Now, I can understand if progressives in safe states like California, where there's no chance of Trump prevailing, if they wanted to really send a message that by casting a vote for Stein. But I have to defer to Noam Chomsky, who I think is one of the left's most foremost intellectuals, when he said that if he lived, he would prefer Bernie Sanders, but if he lived in a swing state and it came down to Trump or Hillary Clinton, he would vote for Hillary just because the alternative is just so awful.
Let me hit you with a couple. So essentially, if I understand your case here, you're saying if you're a progressive Bernie Sanders supporter, if you live in a swing state, you need to get in there and support Hillary Clinton, hold your nose and vote for Hillary Clinton. But if you have the luxury like you and I do, Ernie, of living out here in California, which we think will go Democratic no matter what, then somebody like you or me, we could go ahead and vote for Jill Stein and give that support to that third party. Am I understanding your basic position correctly?
That is, and let me just add something, because I heard Des bring this up actually during your program yesterday, and that is that it isn't just the court. With what the climate scientists are saying to us right now, mm-hmm. The very survival of humanity could be threatened by a Trump presidency, because Trump had the gall to to suggest that global climate change is a Chinese conspiracy and a hoax. And you've already seen what Republicans have done already. We may not have the time to wait 4 years to do something about climate change.
Let me hit you with a couple of responses that a lot of the folks have very lively conversation. Let me call it a debate in the comment section at bradblog.com on your piece, Revolution at a Crossroad, Ernie Canning. One of the loudest voices, our friend Chicago Mel at bradblog.com says the time is long past for clever and incremental strategies. The revolution is here. The revolution is now. Acquiescence to a rigged system, hoping for table scraps, is not an option. Trump cannot single-handedly make the USA fascist, but the resulting mayhem of his election will finally slap the comatose voters of this country into waking up and regaining their senses. Things actually still need to get worse before they can ever get better. Your response, Ernie Canning.
Well, I could have a lot of responses to it, but on that last point, I believe there, and it's unfortunate we don't have time for the clip here, but I thought during Michael Moore's movie Sicko, there was an interview he did with British MP Tony Benn. And if you get to the point that people are totally demoralized, as occurred during the Bush administration, for example, there's the risk that they drop out of the system altogether rather than get active. So I think this idea that we have to risk a fascist state in order to get people to join the revolution is a false one. In fact, if you saw during the when you have somebody who is really providing hope, which is what the Sanders revolution provided, you see the people turning out. And the interesting feature that I found, I wrote a piece early on about the new generation gap in the media, is that what I found was that where seniors were supporting Hillary Clinton, 85% of seniors get their primary source of news from a corporate-owned television, whereas the millennial generation, where 83% were voting for Sanders, were getting their primary source of news off the Internet, alternative media, foreign media. So I really think it's a matter of, the revolution is not simply about the presidency. You have to target every office. Sure, while you support Hillary, if you have to put her in because you're trying to avoid Trump, at the same time, you're trying to push for Sanders supporters to get in at every office and look at this revolution as a long-term democratic process. And the way you keep moving it forward, I think the critical issue and the question that every thinking progressive has to ask themselves is, what is the most effective means for moving the goals of the democratic revolution forward? And if it's a tactical choice as opposed to, I realize there are a lot of Sanders supporters that have this just visceral dislike of Hillary Clinton, but I think you have to look at the big picture and decide what is best for moving the revolution forward.
Let me read one of those. I'm speaking with Ernie Canning, a senior advisor to vetsforbernie.org, Veterans for Bernie, very quickly because we're short on time. But let me give one comment also left on your article at bradblog.com. This from David Lasagna. He says, I've been saying for decades that we need to change everything. So Bernie was a dream candidate. I was amazed at how well he did, too, actually having a real shot at it, despite the obviously tilted playing field. I have also said in my life that I would never again support Hillary. But in this situation, I will happily choose her over the dumpster. I think Hillary is a mixed bag. I think she's truly accomplished good things and truly done great harm. Both are true. That she is the subject of so much vitriol from the left is weird and disturbing. Yes, she has supported terrible things, but so have the overwhelming majority of our representatives in both houses from both parties. I've got just about a minute here at best. Ernie, your response to David Lasagna's thought there.
Well, it's thoughtful, and I think one thing that people should not overlook is the significant difference between when Obama came into office, there were really very few specific promises he made. In this case, Hillary has, we've accomplished a great deal in terms of the Democratic Party platform, and Hillary has openly committed to it when she gave her Democratic Convention acceptance speech. It's up to us to hold her feet to the fire.
I like that. Let's hold some feet to the fire. Ernie Canning, read his article, Revolution at a Crossroad at bradblog.com. And I think you've now also posted it over at vetsforbernie.org. How are the Vets for Bernie folks responding very quickly to your piece, Ernie?
Well, I had a really fascinating comment from one of our state directors who also served on the committee, and she's basically saying that she intends to hold her nose and vote for Hillary because she basically agrees with everything I've said, except that she thinks that I may have been mistaken about describing Jill Stein as the ideal progressive candidate.
Oh, that's right. This is the woman who pointed out she's a retired U.S. Navy.
She herself is a doctor and a retired captain from the Navy.
Right, and said Jill Stein, she accepts corporate money. Her foreign policy, while happily progressive, is developed out of complete naivete about the world. Not that I disagree with many of her goals. So we got about 3 months for voters to figure all of this out. Glad to have this conversation. Glad to have you writing at bradblog.com, and hope we'll see you writing there more now that we are moving as the Sanders Revolution moves to a new stage, whatever that stage may be. Ernie Canning, check out his work at bradblog.com and at vetsforbernie.org, and you can even find him on the Twitters at Can, that's C-A-N-N, the number 4-I-N-G, Can4ing. For some reason. Hey, Ernie, thanks a bunch, man. We'll be talking to you again soon, I suspect. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Brad.
You bet. All right, a quick break, and we're back with more broadcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It is not on our side, at least not if you talk to the scientists who I talk to about this planet and about the choices that we've got to make. Here was Bill Maher talking, I think this was just last week, talking about this upcoming election and the Democrats, the Bernie Sanders supporters who are trying to figure out what to do.
Finally, new rule from now until Election Day, everything else, every issue, every fight, every cause has to take a backseat to defeating Trump. Mm. He's like an infection. You don't fool around with it. Look, I know liberals are feeling pretty good about Hillary's chances this week, but history has taught us that Democrats are pretty good at blowing elections.
They sure are. And he goes on to say that this is no time for boutique issues in an Armageddon election. Now, a lot of people might disagree that this is an Armageddon election.
Oh, I don't disagree whatsoever. Oh. Because, as you know, we cover climate change, mm-hmm. and the long-term impacts that are already baked in are quite serious. And if we're going to have any chance of even coming close to having a reasonable ability to adapt to it, right. it's going to matter a great deal who the next president is, because all of the decisions that are going to make a huge difference are going to be made in the next 4 to 8 years. Now, people can hope that there's going to be some kind of, you know, utopia that would come about after people have 4 years of Trump, and that's suddenly going to make everything better. they'll see how bad it is, but we'll have locked in infrastructure that will cause serious problems and will be very likely unable to come back from.
Yeah, locked in a climate collapse, essentially, that we might not be able to undo if we take action 4 years later or 8 years later. Since Ernie Canning had mentioned Noam Chomsky here, I was sent this recently on the Twitters by Mr. Anderson. You can reach me on the Twitters at the Brad Blog. This is the great liberal author and intellectual Noam Chomsky. His comments about Donald Trump, maybe this will move some of the still Sanders supporters out there. Maybe it won't. I don't know. This is from last February during the primaries. But I think it's still important to hear from Chomsky today. He was asked about Donald Trump.
The Trump phenomenon. I was wondering if you could expand a little on that and tell us some of the long-term consequences we will have if Trump is indeed put in office.
If Trump is in office?
Yes, sir.
Well, first we have to ask whether he means what he's saying. If he does, not only we, but the human species is in very deep trouble. I'll come back again to global warming. That is a hugely significant phenomenon. I mean, we're now in a situation where the warming of the planet is proceeding at a level about maybe 100, some claim 1,000 times as high as anything in history that can be checked way back in early, long pre-human history. Nothing remotely like it. The effects of global warming are already extremely severe. These are things with really lethal consequences. Now, what is the Republican Party doing? Trump in particular. There was a conference in Paris last December, an international conference, which tried to set some policies to prevent the global warming before it destroys us. It made some progress, not anywhere near enough. But the goal was to reach a treaty among the countries of the world where they would commit themselves to these measures, inadequate measures, but at least some, couldn't be implemented. Very simple reason. The Republican Congress would not accept it. So therefore there's no treaty, just verbal commitments. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Republican majority on the Supreme Court sharply violated precedent to block limited measures to reduce the extensive pollution from coal plants. Well, that's a message to the world, and that message is heard, saying don't bother doing anything because the United States is not going to allow it because of the Republican Party. Going back to Trump, he simply says it's not happening, so I'm not going to do anything about it. Right now, the spectacle of the Republican primaries is frightening people around the world justifiably. He says all sorts of things. Some of them make sense, some of them are crazy. It's hard to know what he means. But, you know, the U.S. is an extremely powerful state. To have somebody who's kind of a wild man with his finger on the button that could destroy the world, namely the nuclear weapons button, where it could make decisions of enormous influence, I think is a very frightening prospect.
Frightening indeed. That was Noam Chomsky, liberal intellectual from back in February. You know, if Ernie Canning, senior advisor at Vets for Bernie, can't convince you the importance of this election, if we had Sean King, fierce Sanders supporter on last week, you know, saying with regret he would be supporting Hillary Clinton just because the menace of Donald Trump at this point is so horrible. If none of that convinces you as a Sanders supporter, then who knows? Maybe Noam Chomsky will. Any thoughts on what he had to say there, Des, before we get out?
Yeah, just to sort of expand on the idea that, remember that, say, for example, you vote for a third-party candidate, you're in a swing state. The swing state, then, those electoral votes instead go to Donald Trump. Trump is elected. That means that a Trump administration would be in control of all three branches of government, House and Senate, that's Congress, passing laws that presumably a President Donald Trump would sign, and also putting in Supreme Court justices up to, you know, 2 to 3, mm-hmm. that would then approve those laws as being constitutional, not just rolling back voting rights, but dismissing environmental regulations and climate change regulations, plus those down ballot tickets that mm-hmm. people, if they don't vote for folks who uphold progressive values and environmental regulations, we also have state-level control that reverts to conservatives and right-wingers who have no interest whatsoever in preparing the country for climate change.
We don't tell people who to vote for here, and I support voters of any stripe, including, by the way, voters of Donald Trump. But we do hope that people are armed with the facts when they head into that voting booth. and understand what they're doing. I want to hear from a lot of people saying, oh, it needs to get worse before it can get better. I'd be okay if Donald Trump was in so that people could really see how bad it is. You know, I guess those are people who think they could survive that. They are privileged enough to be able to survive that. There are a lot of people who would not survive those 4 years. And it's amazing to me how people have forgotten the 8 years of George W. Bush, for Christ's sake. And I don't think he was anywhere near as insane as Donald Trump. In any event, well, we'll be back with you tomorrow talking about this and much more, I suspect, in the days ahead. My thanks again to Ernest A. Canning of bradblog.com and vetsforbernie.org, to our producer Desi Doyen, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it and all the other ones for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and I'm on the Facebooks and the Twitters at TheBradBlog. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.